Well, thank you very much, Tim, and thank you all for coming out tonight. We were just in the back discussing the new T-shirt, which will have an Ann Arbor symbol on it, all in green. It'll say, "I survived the winter of 14." And we're all going to need one of those, I think, as things move along. I appreciate you mentioning the Alliance to Save Energy. We're hosting a conference, which will have national invitees here on the 31st, and that it will be. We're doing that in conjunction with the University of Michigan and the Alliance to Save Energy. So it's a kind of a big deal, and people will be coming from all over, we hope, to attend that conference. It will be in a wonderful new auditorium over at the Business School, which I'm told is a LEED Gold building. So that's a good thing, I guess. But we'll certainly be there. I just wanted to take a few minutes and talk about, certainly some of my co-conspirators on the Energy Commission are here tonight. One of them will be our moderator. And let me mention, too, we also have one of our city council members with us, Christopher Taylor's with us. Thanks for coming out tonight. And we have Missy Stoltz from the Parks Administration Commission. And we have Environmental Commission members as well. And Environmental? Yes. Oh, yes, we have one right here. Okay. So we're covering the bases on that. And I just wanted to talk a minute about what's happening nationally and bring that back to the local level a little bit. When you look at what's really happening in our country and now in places around the world, and I got to tell you, I'm very disappointed in Canada, in the kind of turn that they've made away from moving towards climate protection, and they're doing it with tar sands, really, and they're trying to spread that into the United States. But that's only part of it. But if you take a look at our national government, whatever we think about their gridlock and their inability to agree on anything, they're not going to do anything. There's nothing on the horizon that they're going to do to combat climate change. It does not appear that they're going to get it together to do anything. And in fact, there are, on one side of the aisle, a number of deniers, but then even on the other side of the aisle, there don't seem to be enough folks that want to push this issue hard enough to embarrass the folks on the other side. So the task has fallen to cities for the most part. And if you look at Seattle, if you look at other cities across the country, Chicago's trying to do their part. Cities like Ann Arbor, Madison, Boulder, we're certainly trying to do our part. We've been at this for a long time in Ann Arbor, which makes our task a little bit easier. It also probably makes it a little bit harder. It's harder for us to make an improvement on the energy we use because we've been trying to save energy for so long, and we've made so much progress. Back in 2011, we hit the benchmark of 20% renewable energy for everything the city government does. And the task now is to spread that out and to get our citizens involved and our businesses involved. And I'll tell you, this is part of that. This forum, this series of forums, is part of getting the public on board and educated about this issue and moving forward. And there are many, many people in Ann Arbor who have already taken it upon themselves. You see roofs. I see the owner of a home here tonight with a roof covered with solar panels. And there's so much insulation going on and so many things like that. Companies are taking advantage of the PACE program, Property Assessed Clean Energy, where the city will help them to make their building more efficient. One of the pieces of legislation that's come out of the Energy Commission, which I've sponsored for the next agenda of City Council, will start a program where buildings, the larger buildings, we're going to start with them first, will report their energy usage. And when you get to them down to the reporting of something, as we all know, when the environmental movement finally got the EPA to force companies just to report the amount of pollution they were producing, we began to have a tool that we could then use to say, hey, you need to reduce this. This is damaging the environment to this degree. And it actually became a point where companies were trying to become more green. And we're very hopeful that what's happened in some places and the other places in the country, this is something that's happened in larger cities, you begin to see building owners taking advantage of this information to say, I could be saving money, and that's what reducing energy use really is all about. I can not only save energy, I can do something green, I can save money. And when you get to that level, it's a lot easier to get, perhaps easier to get people's attention. But these forums are building up the education of our community, and that's our next task. We want to continue. We want to get the city to 30% renewable energy for city government, to 40%, to 50% renewable energy. But we also need to get the general public on board and moving forward towards renewable energy. A big, big part of that Doesn't mean you've got to put up any solar panels or anything. Just become as well insulated as you can be and use as little energy across the board. And it really is something that can be joyful as you participate and you try to move forward in these types of endeavors. And obviously can be good. These little steps are what we're going to have to do in cities across the country, because as I say, nationally, I don't think our government is going to do anything for a long time. And that's a sad story. But we can be happy here tonight. We have some good environmentalists with us. We have one of them that's going to lead off our panel. That's Mike Schreiberg, who is someone that I have the pleasure of serving with on the Energy Commission. And he's going to be introducing the rest of our panel. And we will get this evening started. Mike?
Well, I first want to start by thanking Mayor Hiefje. The mayor has been a steadfast advocate for energy and climate issues in the face of economic and, frankly, some political headwinds on this. And he has stayed true to that. And he's made a personal commitment to this, too. I mean, on the Energy Commission, he serves himself and has advanced some of the great things that we do there. So I want to start by thanking the mayor. Mayor Hiefje said, you know, the actions at the local level. I'll say I work at University of Michigan. I teach energy policy. I work at our Sustainability Institute as the education director. And I've spent time professionally in the nonprofit sector working at the Ecology Center and at Environment Michigan working on energy and climate policy. But I'm spending my time now at the local level. And that's because that's where I think we're going to make the most progress. I'm on the Energy Commission here. I was on the Climate Action Planning Task Force, and I'm going to explain a little bit more what that is. And I've recently agreed to be a co-chair of the Community Climate Partnership. And that's really what we're launching today. All of our speakers here today are part of this Community Climate Partnership, and it's going to be our chance as a community to really engage and make the climate plans go. Now, to start this off, I want to provide just a little bit of context with a video here that comes from the Post-Carbon Institute. Now, this is a place that's done some great work on making the transition to fossil fuels smooth.
It all started with a big bang. Wait, we don't have to go back that far. The Earth was formed 4.5 billion years ago. No, still too far. Try this. It's the Middle Ages. People in Britain run out of firewood, start burning coal. But they use up the coal on the ground. Miners dig deep. Coal mines fill with water. Samuel Newcomen invents a coal-burning steam engine to pump out water so miners can keep digging. James Watt makes it practical for other uses. Now we have ingredients for the Industrial Revolution, fossil fuels, and a way to put them to work. All hell breaks loose. Coal miners bog down lugging coal. Rails make it easier. Rails and steam engine combined make a railroad. Michael Faraday makes the first electric motor. Nikola Tesla invents alternating current. Soon utility companies start burning coal to generate electricity. Meanwhile, Edwin Drake drills the first rock oil well in Pennsylvania, and Carl Daimler builds an automobile running on petroleum. Coal tar and oil are turned into industrial chemicals and pharmaceuticals that prolong life, more population growth. The Wright brothers start oil-fueled aviation. Fritz Haber and Carl Bosch make fertilizer from fossil fuels. Fertilizer and oil-powered tractors expand food production, feeding more people. World War I is the first fossil-fueled conflict. Then comes World War II, giving us guided missiles and atom bombs. In between is a Great Depression, partly caused by overproduction. Powered assembly lines make products faster than people need them. Advertising executives invent consumerism to soak up overproduction. It's the 1950s. Advertisers use television to hook new generations of consumers. In the 70s, there's an oil shock. Everyone's shocked to realize how dependent they are on oil. With the energy crisis, the environmental movement is born. But oil prices fall and everyone forgets energy shortages. There's a showdown between market and planned economies. Market wins. Goodbye, evil Soviet Empire. Politicians decide the market will solve everything. Personal computers arrive. Globalization takes over when the market notices labor is cheaper in China. Suddenly everyone has a cell phone, but world oil production stalls out. China is now burning half the world's coal to make export products. But where will China get more coal and oil to fuel more growth? Environmental problems everywhere. Rising CO2 levels lead to record heat waves, floods, droughts. Oceans acidify. Topsoil erodes by 25 billion tons a year from industrial agriculture. Ancient forests disappear. Species go extinct at 1,000 times normal rates. Fresh water is scarce or polluted. Oil companies drill in miles of seawater because the easy oil is gone. But a deep water oil platform explodes and fouls the Gulf of Mexico. Manufacturing moves to polluting countries where labor is cheap, while the U.S. becomes a casino. The financial sector is 40% of the economy. But Wall Street is overleveraged. Banks fail. Unemployment soars. Credit evaporates. The economy's on the verge of collapse. Okay, present time. It's amazing how far we've come in 200 years, just three human lifetimes, from the beginning of industrialism till now. But where are we headed? We can't keep doubling human population. We can't keep dumping carbon in the atmosphere. We can't keep ruining topsoil. We can't keep growing population and consumption or basing our economy on depleting fossil fuels. We can't just print more money to solve the debt crisis. It's been an exhilarating ride, but there are limits. Now, it's not the end of the world, but we have to do four things fast. Learn to live without fossil fuels. Adapt to the end of economic growth as we've known it. Support 7 billion humans and stabilize population at a sustainable level and deal with our legacy of environmental destruction. In short, we have to live within nature's budget of renewable resources at rates of natural replenishment. Can we do it? We have no choice. Alternative energy sources are important, but none can fully replace fossil fuels in the time we have. Also, we've designed and built our infrastructure for transport, electricity, and farming to suit oil, coal, and gas. Changing to different energy sources will require us to redesign cities, manufacturing processes, healthcare, and more. We'll also have to rethink some of our cultural values. None of our global problems can be tackled in isolation, and many cannot be fully solved. We have to prepare for business as unusual. Our best goal is resilience, the ability to absorb shocks and keep going. If we do nothing, we still get to a post-carbon future, but it will be bleak. However, if we plan the transition, we can have a world that supports robust communities of healthy, creative people and ecosystems with millions of other species. One way or the other, we're in for the ride of a lifetime. Understand the issues and pitch in. It's all hands on deck.
Now, Mayor Hifshia talked about some of the bad news here. And I would say the bad news is coming from our political leadership in Washington, right? That's not where this problem is going to get solved. That is clear. I actually think there was a big opportunity blown in Obama's first term. Lots of blame to go around. Obama himself deserves some of it, right? But there's no question that at the federal level, there's little to nothing that's going to happen in the short term. State level, unfortunately, is very similar right now. Our state leadership, if anything, has been moving the opposite way on these issues. The special interests, the utilities, and others really have a very tight grip on our state political infrastructure, right? So we can't be looking towards the state, but the local level is where it could happen, and there are amazing things happening. And one example of this is what's been happening with solar. We have a huge boom in solar. And actually, I don't have the year 2013 on here, but I just heard that it was the biggest year ever for solar, right, in the U.S. And actually in China, Wayne Appleyard, our energy commission chair, just shared this with me. China alone actually produced more solar capacity than the rest of the world last year. And so the boom is happening globally on this. The state that we're at, and we're kind of going from the big picture, and we're going to narrow in a bit to the communities in just a moment here, is we're beyond the scientific and technical challenges here. I think those have been solved or are solvable right now when we talk about climate change. But as my colleague Andy Hoffman at the Urban Institute says, it's about building a social consensus to act right now. And the social consensus begins and maybe ends in our own communities. And that's really what we're talking about here, and it's where the action is and should be. Now, in Ann Arbor, we have an amazing base for this. Okay, so first, the city, and great kudos to our city's energy staff, to Mayor Hiefje and the rest, because Ann Arbor is ahead on this. Ann Arbor has been working really hard on this. And the first thing, of course, is to see where actually our greenhouse gas emissions are coming from. And what's interesting here, one, of course, we have a big driver of the university. That's about a third of our emissions, and that's just the direct emissions from the university. I mean, you have to, of course, know that's, you know, a campus of 80,000 people. That's part of it, and that doesn't include transportation to and from. That's the direct emissions from the university. But when we look at what's driving it here, it's about a quarter of everything else is from transportation, from our homes, and from our businesses, right? If we look at the city itself, all right, so what the city directly controls, municipal emissions, it is less than 2% of the overall emissions. Wastewater treatment plant and things like that drive that. So what does that mean? Well, it means that the efforts that have to happen have to come from us in our homes, you know, in our vehicles, how we get places, and from our businesses, right? There's no sort of substitute for looking at it in that way. Now, the city has commissioned a climate action plan, okay? And this plan was fantastic, had lots of community support. Many people in this room actually were involved in drafting this up and came up with really strong targets. And the emissions targets are 8% reductions by 2015, 25% by 2025, and 90% by 2050. And I'll say, you know, we took a strong position when we were drafting the climate action plan that we need to base this on the physics, the laws of thermodynamics, and what the best scientists are saying, not on the politics and the economics, because we think that can follow. Now, I'm not saying we drafted an unrealistic plan, but what we did do, and what you see here, is that black line is business as usual. All right, if we do nothing based on a 0.7% emissions growth, sorry, it's a little bit smudged, but you can get the general idea, we have to get to that line below, that green line below. And that means there's a lot of work to do to get there, and it's completely reliant on citizen participation. And in some ways, I believe that starts tonight. Now, there are amazing things that have already been happening in this community. And what we're asking people to do at this set forum tonight is to start submitting ideas, stories of what you are doing, what you would like to be doing, what you've been inspired by. And we have a board up there. The board, I can't see it. Oh, it's in the back there, that has that. And Nate and Monica, two of the folks who have been involved in this, are going to circulate cards where you can write this down. You may already have these. But we want to start gathering these community stories because it's really important to us. And I also want to say we're going to start this conversation here. We're going to continue the conversation. Hopefully folks can join us. We're going to Arbor Brewing Company, to the tap room at 8:30. These are hard conversations. A little lubrication never hurts for them, right? So we invite everybody to join us afterward to do that. So I want to close what I have to say and introduce the rest of the speakers with a quote from one of my favorite thinkers on this, and this is Paul Hawken. Paul Hawken wrote The Ecology of Commerce, and he recently gave this address at a graduation ceremony. The speech is called You Are Brilliant and the Earth is Hiring. He says, basically, civilization needs a new operating system. You are the programmers, and we need it within a few decades. The planet came with a set of instructions, but we seem to have misplaced them. If you look at the science about what is happening on Earth and aren't pessimistic, you don't understand that data. But if you meet the people who are working to restore this Earth and the lives of the poor, and you aren't optimistic, you haven't got a pulse. Do what needs to be done and check to see if it was impossible only after you are done. And I think that should be how we move forward as a community. So to start us on the path, tonight we have a lineup of folks from the Community Climate Partnership, all involved in different ways. And we're going to start by looking at what some other communities are doing, not only on mitigation, so stopping climate change, but on adaptation, because we know impacts are happening right now and how our community is going to respond to that. And then we're going to sort of talk about what's happening within our own community here. And then we're going to end directly with ways to get involved and then open it up for Q&A. That's our format for the evening. So let me introduce Missy Stoltz, my colleague at the University of Michigan. She's a science research fellow there. She's also a commissioner on the City of Ann Arbor Parks Advisory Commission and the Energy Commission. She's going to tell us a little bit about some of the adaptation efforts of other cities. So thanks, Missy.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for making the trip out tonight. So I am going to talk to you a little bit about climate adaptation. But before I start, just a show of hands, How many of you in your home, in your life, are undertaking efforts to reduce your energy consumption? Not surprising. How many of you are taking efforts to prepare for extreme weather and climate change? That is more surprising. That's great. I'm going to talk to you today a bit more about what we can do to prepare for climate change, the impacts that we're experiencing. Now, Ann Arbor has a long history of both mitigation, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and preparing for climate change. But when I talk about climate adaptation, I just want to put up a little definition here for you. It really is about making sure that we are prepared for any adjustments that may happen short-term in weather or long-term in climate. And that's about making sure we seize on opportunities that may exist in a changing climate. We don't often talk about that, but there are some opportunities. Could be a longer growing season. Hard to imagine today, but it's possible. It could be longer tourist seasons and more opportunities to bring in economic revenue. But there are a lot of negative ramifications of climate change, too. So adaptation is making sure that we're being proactive, thinking about projected and existing changes, and preparing society for those changes. What we really need to have and what the city of Ann Arbor is thinking about is a dual approach. And this is a tagline from a report that came out from the United Nations that a mentor of mine helped work on, which is what we really have to do and how I think about this issue is we've got to make sure that we are doing everything possible to avoid the unmanageable. So we need to mitigate to the extent that we can. But we also have to acknowledge that there are some things that we have to manage. So we need to avoid the unmanageable and manage the unavoidable. So that's kind of the tagline of what I think about when I think about preparedness. How many of you have actually read the city's climate action plan? It's a good read. Get in there. It's graphically pleasing. It's lovely. When you take a look at that, you're going to be overwhelmed with the number of mitigation activities or activities to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The city also acknowledged the need to prepare. This is not as robust of a section, but a lot of us are working on building this out, and this is because it's a relatively new field if you look broadly at what cities are doing to prepare for climate change. So there are five strategies, and I list them here. Slides will be made available so you can take a look, or you could just go to the plan directly. But there's a different degree here. The strategies that we see in Ann Arbor's plan tend to be at a higher level, like protect our citizens. Good goal. What we have to do now is figure out how we do that, right? So we're all working to kind of actualize these strategies, bring them down a level, and figure out how do you operationalize these components. But broadly, these are the things we've agreed upon as a community. What I want to do now is step outside of Ann Arbor, and I'm going to take you on a tour nationally of what cities are doing to prepare for climate change. My background is working with cities. I moved to Ann Arbor about 18 months ago. Delighted to be here. Enjoyed the first year a little bit more weather-wise, but, you know, it's all right. It's a journey. So I'm going to take some experience working with cities. There are literally hundreds of examples that I could share with you about what's happening around the country, but let's not belabor it. Let's jump in. Broadly, this is a planning process. It's probably very similar to anyone who's ever done any planning or thinks about how you plan in your home, you plan at a city scale, you plan at a national level. Generally, throughout this process, the first three are where cities are. They're identifying the risks and the vulnerabilities from extreme weather and climate change. Many are starting to plan or think about the different options that they could implement to address those risks that they're facing. Less are implementing, but we are starting to see a ramp up of the number of communities actually doing things on the ground, changing policies, putting in infrastructure, building social capital, lots of different strategies. Where we don't have a lot of work is in the last two phases of a good planning process. That's monitoring and evaluating what we've actually done on the ground, and then, of course, revising, being very iterative, going back to this process, sharing our lessons learned with our peers. So we're starting to see communities move through this process, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we know on the ground. So let's go to our neighbor to start. Chicago, Illinois, leads the nation really in green roofs. They have, well, they're one of the top in terms of total square footage of green roofs in the community. A little fun anecdote. I'm going to do what I'm not supposed to do, and I'm going to walk. This is Chicago City Hall. This is a state building. You can see on the far side, there's no green roof. On the city side, there is a green roof. On a very hot day, they went out to the roofs and measured temperature. Temperature on the green roof side was in the 90s. Temperature on the non-green roof side was around 150 degrees. Massive amounts of cooling coming from green roofs. So Chicago's certainly been leading a national charge in this area. And they've also been doing some really fascinating work around green alleys. If you spent some time in Chicago, you know there are a lot of alleyways. It's kind of where neighborhoods are based. A lot of them are vacant. They've been using those alleys, kind of tearing up the existing infrastructure and putting in pervious pavement so that water will absorb. So it's a stormwater management feature. But they got a side benefit. When they did that, they made those alleys much more inviting. And neighbors started to come out into the streets. And they started to talk to each other. And they started to have neighborhood block parties. And they created a living space. And so they're scaling up their green alley program. So not only are they managing stormwater, they're building this critical thing called social capital, which is really important as we think about adaptation. Boulder, Colorado. Boulder is one of 33 cities that were just selected by the Rockefeller Foundation in their 100 Resilient Cities program to help massively scale up resilience efforts. Boulder's been pretty hammered in the last few years. Not only did they have a massive drought, they then followed that up with a wildfire and then extreme flooding. So Boulder is really thinking about how to move forward. They have for a long time been focusing on water, which makes a lot of sense. So if you look at Boulder's strategies, there's a lot around water conservation that they've been doing. But what I think is really important, when we talk about resilience, which is a core part of adaptation, we often think about this idea of bouncing back. But you can imagine that there are people who don't want to bounce back to where they are now. If you're poor or if you're struggling, why would you want to come back? So it's not about bouncing back. It's about bouncing forward. And that's what Boulder is trying to do through a community effort, is vision what the future could be when they're more resilient to all kinds of impacts and stresses. Heading down to Dubuque, Iowa, Dubuque also faced some pretty extreme flooding recently. In order to address this, they've been doing some work around building a new wastewater treatment facility to manage the capacity that's coming in, and they're following Chicago's footprint and starting a massive green alley program to try to manage stormwater on-site throughout the city. I don't know if you can see that, but it's a house in the background. There's about 5 feet of standing water. I'm trying to give you a lot of different impacts that communities are facing. So we talked a little bit about flooding. We've talked a little bit about heat. Drought is certainly an issue. California is just coming out of the most extreme drought that the state has ever faced. This is a reality. We're pretty water rich here. One of the things that we want to think about, though, is because we're water rich, are we going to have an influx of people from water-poor regions, and can our infrastructure handle that? Do we have the facilities and the capacity to deal that with that influx of additional people and additional needs on our social systems? So El Paso, just as an example here, obviously they have extreme heat. They face drought repeatedly. And so they're doing a lot of work on water conservation, reaching out into the community, using trusted advisors, using the religious networks that they have to actually get in homes and help people reduce water consumption broadly and water costs, because it does cost for water. Lewis, Delaware is a very small community of about 2,000. They were the first community in the nation to work with FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, to integrate climate change into their hazard mitigation planning process. This is really, really important because we talk a lot in the adaptation field about having no silver bullet. In the climate mitigation field, there's a very clear silver bullet. It's called energy efficiency. No matter where you are, it is always smart to be as efficient as possible. Then you can talk about renewable energy, and then you talk about other strategies. But climate impacts are local. Not every community faces the same threats. And so there's not one strategy that you can tell everyone to do. The closest strategy we have is this: integrate climate change into your hazard planning. Why this is really important is, and apologies if anyone knows this, but hazard mitigation planning comes from FEMA, which was mandated to do this through the Stafford Act, which was a congressionally approved act. And it requires that you plan for hazards based on historic hazards that you've experienced. But climate change is changing history, literally. And so if you're preparing for a previous hazard, you're probably not prepared for a future hazard that's going to be more intense, more frequent, or possibly more severe, of longer duration. So we have all of these communities. There are about 22,000 communities that have hazard mitigation plans, but those plans don't have climate change in them. So Lewis was a pilot for FEMA to figure out how you integrate climate change into that process. This is significant. So there's been some work to replicate this in other parts of the country. Biloxi, Mississippi gets a little shout out here for a lot of the work they've been doing around disasters. The Gulf Coast is the most disastrous part of our country, if you look at the number of total disaster declarations that we face. And so they are similarly looking at how to integrate climate change into their hazard mitigation process. But they've been doing some really important outreach to stakeholders because there's a high transition of people. So people come in and don't know how to prepare for disasters because they've never experienced them before. So there's a lot of outreach going through the real estate agencies, through neighborhood associations to teach people about the vulnerabilities that they face. Seattle, I'm going to cue this up because Susan, I think, is going to talk to us a bit about Ann Arbor and how we can do something similar to this. Seattle gets national attention for their neighborhood work. They have a Department of Neighborhoods, and the entire intent there is to revitalize or reinvigorate all of the neighborhoods so that people know each other, that if a disaster were to hit, you don't call the city, you go to your neighbor. You actually build social capital. It took my husband and I probably 3 months before we really knew one of our neighbors when we moved to Ann Arbor. That's not great news, folks. So the idea is, how do we build social capital and make our community stronger throughout the board? I am almost out of time. Well, I am out of time. So I'm just going to pause here for a second. We've got urban food, great work happening. We've got collaboration across jurisdictional boundaries. Climate impacts don't start and stop in Ann Arbor. They cross borders. So we have to find ways to work with our surrounding communities, the region broadly, to really prepare. And we've got some models of this happening, and we're following these really closely. But in conclusion, really what we know, climate action is happening at the local level. It makes sense. Impacts are at the local level. Our actors are small, medium, and large. They're all size of cities, townships, villages, boroughs. It's everything you can imagine. They're geographically diverse. They're somewhat politically diverse. There is a tilt here that you could imagine. They're often driven by more than just climate change. It's driven by the economy. It's driven by sustainability goals or agendas that exist. There are a lot of different motivators. Most of these places are economically challenged, and they're struggling with how to implement strategies, but they're finding this as a mechanism to bring in people and bring in business. We're not doing as much as we need to. We need to scale up, and we need your help to figure out how we can do that here in Ann Arbor. But ultimately, cities are centers for innovation, experimentation, and solution setting. And together, we're going to figure out how to do that. So thank you.
So thanks. So next we have Rebecca Esselman from the she's a watershed planner with the Huron River Watershed Council, and she's really been leading the efforts in this community to work on adaptation strategies.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for making it out in the cold. I'm excited about the part of the story that I get to share with you because I get to share with you what we're doing right here in this community pertaining to climate adaptation in particular. So I'm going to describe some of the efforts that we're undertaking as part of the Huron River Watershed Council that is has very strong involvement from Ann Arbor. The project's called Creating Climate Resilient Communities, and we're working on getting climate adaptation going out of the planning phase and into the implementation phase in ways that will really help our community be resilient to changes in our climate. So the impetus for the project, more and more the partners that we worked with at the Watershed Council were expressing interest in incorporating climate change into what they did, into decisions that they made. I know this is a problem. I don't know what to do about it. I hear national statistics. I hear global statistics. None of that really captures what is happening here and, you know, the information that I need to make a decision on the ground that will respect our climate future. So we set out to help fill that knowledge gap. And what we did was we brought together climate scientists and we brought together the practitioners in the water resource sector. As a watershed council, we're thinking a lot about water. So our work is centered on water resources. So we got these folks in a room together and started to try to chip away at what answering the questions about what do you need, what kind of information do you need. Let's dig into the data, dig into the science, and here's the best that we can share with you now about what we know. You know, how does this help you do your work? So it was also very sector-driven. We facilitated the process, did not lead the development of solutions, respecting the fact that folks in a profession know best about their profession, how climate and weather intersects what they do, and let them figure out the most important things to tackle. based on the information that, we could share with them. So we asked these groups of folks, how does climate change affect your business? Your business as usual, what you do in your day-to-day. We started by sharing with them as much local climate information as we could and asked them, how does this change what you do? And then what additional information could you use that's actionable, something that you can actually take and run with that would change your practices to make them more adapted to climate change? The focus of my talk today is not going to be the details of any graphic or a real in-depth characterization of how climate's changing here. These are just a couple of graphics to illustrate some of the information that we were showing to members of our sectors, letting them know that annually average temperatures are increasing, annually we're seeing more rain and snow, and it's cut off at the bottom, but some of the prevailing information is we're just seeing a lot more variability and a lot more extremes. I want to credit GLESA. I didn't do it on the slide. GLESA were our climate scientists. That's the Great Lakes Integrated Sciences and Assessment. They're a group out of University of Michigan and Michigan State. And if you want to find, if you want to dig into the weeds of the data, look at glisa.umich.edu. Okay, so you guys recognize this place? Anyone? Anyone? Yeah, okay. Everyone knows this place, right? It's a big place. I want to use the stadium to give you an illustration of the magnitude of climate changes we're already seeing, okay? So this is looking back at historic record, not even looking forward. And, of course, models tell us a lot of the trends we're seeing in our historic record are just going to keep going, okay? So anyone want to guess? And nobody that was in the room while I was adjusting the slides and might have seen the answer. Anyone want to guess at how many Michigan stadiums we fill in rainfall every year? In Ann Arbor? Somebody throw out a number. 117. That's how much water we have to manage on the ground here every year. And this is a lot of water, and this is 23 more stadiums than we experienced here just 30 years ago. So if you think about how we manage water in urban environments, it's through a lot of infrastructure, pipes and detention ponds and all of those things, most of which are in an ideal situation in the ground 50 years, and in more realistic situations are in the ground 100 years, 70 years. We were not planning for this amount of rain when that stuff went into the ground. So we have some real issues that we face with the magnitude of change that we're seeing already. And there's a cascade of implications beyond infrastructure. We have flooding issues, erosion, polluted runoff getting to our rivers, wear and tear on our infrastructure. So a cascade of implications from changes like this. So when armed with this type of information, our sector teams came up with some really great strategies to start preparing for what we're seeing and what's coming. I'm going to share a few of those stories with you today. We have a group that's focused on in-stream flows and hydrology, or sort of the ebb and flow of our rivers. Faced with the information that we were going to see bigger and more frequent storms, they said, whoa, that makes us very vulnerable to more detrimental flood events and dam failures. Okay, so these are issues that have implications for economics, for public safety, and for the environment. So their solution, one of the solutions, was to develop the Huron River Dams Network. If you see a map of the watershed that Ann Arbor is in, those triangles along the river are all dams on the main stem of the river. There's 16 of them. There's 8 different management agencies, and historically, these groups don't talk. The individuals that operate a dam upstream don't necessarily talk to their downstream neighbors, or maybe one or two stream dams, you know, next door, but certainly not coordinated across the watershed. And speaking to Missy's point that these things don't follow government boundaries, water is a perfect illustration of that. You get a flooding upland in Oakland County, you're going to feel it in Washtenaw. And so it's very important to network these folks. They have met, we've had two, our second annual meeting is coming up next week. There's an email list connecting them. They all have each other's contact information at this point. It's already allowing them to communicate about day-to-day operations to do that better, and they'll be connected in case of an emergency situation. So preparedness here has increased dramatically just by getting these folks talking. Another group was our group focused on stormwater. So we talked about all that rain that falls on Ann Arbor, and Ann Arbor is a lot of pavement, and we have to do stuff. We have to do something with that water when it falls. So when told that storm intensity, duration, and frequency was increasing, this to them raised a red flag about inadequate stormwater management systems. So how do we accommodate what's coming when we built for a different climatic setting? So their solution was to adopt revised storm definitions. This gets a little technical, but essentially there are definitions of storm events, how much is going to fall and how much time, and probabilities assigned to those. And so the current definitions that were being used or that are being used to make stormwater decisions were based on data that hadn't been updated in 30 years. The federal government, NOAA, just revised these storm definitions. And what I want to impart on you here is how dramatic the changes are in some cases about the number that was used to make decisions in the past and our reality currently. So this storm, you guys might recognize this spot on the map. This is U of M's campus. This was last summer. This was a small event. This is all cut off. Okay, you're going to have to listen to my numbers and not the my graphic because it didn't show up well in this format. So this is a 1.5-inch rain event, okay, that caused this much flooding. Now, granted, that 1.5 inches fell really quickly, and that often leads to flooding. But our 1% chance storm was historically over 4 inches, okay? 1% chance storm is, there's 1% chance each year that a storm of this magnitude is going to occur. So that's the historic 1%. When the revisions came in, we added more than another inch to that, a 17% increase in rainfall for those really large events. So getting municipalities to make decisions based on the new storm definitions rather than the old ones is really important. Washtenaw County is already doing this. They're taking the lead on it, and I commend them for that. Development in the future from here forward is going to require much more strict adherence or much more strict guidelines for infiltrating water on building sites rather than allowing it to run off. So step in the right direction there. And the last one I'll touch on real quick, one of our sector teams was focused on natural areas and urban forests. And this group said, okay, the seasons are shifting, the temperatures are increasing, we're getting more drought. This has a lot of consequences for the composition of species that are going to do well here. Which ones are going to do well, which ones aren't, and then let's start thinking about what that means for the management of natural and urban forests. So the table shows which species are going to do better, which is indicated by the plus sign, kind of neutral, the zeros, and are going to decline in the future with the negatives. And just one illustration of what that could mean or the implications of it is aesthetic. What we have here is fall color in the beech maple forest that's most common here now. Our future climate's more conducive to oak and hickory, which is a lovely forest type too. I'm a botanist in training, and I love them all. But it's browns and muted colors, which is very different than what we're used to, and we actually have a pretty substantial economy built on our fall color. So these folks have built a toolkit to start educating land managers on some of the changes in species composition in our forests. So that's just a quick view of what some of the things that are happening here in the Ann Arbor area and the Watershed Council. I did want to say, to Missy's point about hazard mitigation, we're starting a fourth sector team this year that's in part because of the climate action plan here in Ann Arbor to start working with emergency management professionals and folks that work with hazard mitigation to start looking at those plans and see if we can't infuse better climate information into our mitigation of natural hazards and our preparedness to respond. That's where you can find more information on the project and where you can find me.
Thank you, Rebecca. So let me introduce Susan Hutt. Susan is the vice chair of the Energy Commission here and is a writer and poet by training. And she's been doing a lot of work with organizing at the community level, and she's going to talk with some of that.
Hi, I'm Susan Hutton, and I'm the vice chair of the Environmental Commission, and I'm going to talk about what we as individuals can do about climate change. I'm not a scientist, and I'm not a policy person. I'm a writer, and I am a mom, and I've been interested in climate change since I was in college. And I've had a hard time trying to wrap my mind around the scale and the effectiveness that I can have as an individual. And when I've tried, I've come up against things like this, which, you know, sometimes I can figure out the math if I really button down and try to slog through it. Sometimes I can't. I don't have the acronyms. I don't have the background. But what I want to know and what I've had a hard time trying to figure out is how far are we from where we need to be and what do we need to do to get there? And the two things that recently I have found really helpful are our city's climate action plan and a diagram that refers to the behavior wedge. Our climate action plan was passed in the city of Ann Arbor in December of 2012. And it gives us a map and an outline, and it talks about where we are and what we live, and it has all kinds of goals that we can follow that are pragmatic things for each of us to think about and to try to implement, which I really admire. Mike talked quite a bit about this, not quite a bit, he talked a little bit about this earlier, but our emissions are kind of broken out here, and as he said, residential is 22%, commercial and industrial is 25%, transportation, 22%, and U of M's 30%. And the area that I'm interested in talking about tonight is the residential sector, the 2%, which is where I most familiarly inhabit. And these are the goals. You know, our goals for 2015 are to reduce our emissions by 8%, by 2025 by 25%, and by 2050 by 90%. So how do we get there? So we look at this. And if you add up our numbers again, 22%, 22%, 25%, 30%, we're at 99%. And as Mike said, 1.2% of our emissions come from the city of Ann Arbor. And so if we look at our residential emissions, that means that even though our city has passed the climate action plan, the action has to come from us. So what are ways that we can do that as individuals? You probably have seen these before. I know I've seen them before. Change your bulbs. Buy and use a programmable thermostat. Maybe you are like me and the programmable thermostat is not really easy to read. I have found that if I Google my thermostat maker and the model, there's a YouTube video that I can set up on my laptop right next to my thermostat, and there's some helpful person that will guide me through every step. I do it every October. It works. Unplug your gadgets. Walk, bike, carpool, take public transit. I am a huge fan of Google Maps. I can plug in my location. My phone will find where I am. Google Maps will say, there's this bus. Here's the bus stop. It'll take you this long to walk there. Here's how many stops you need to wait before you get off the bus. That kind of intimidation factor that I feel when I'm trying something new gets reduced a lot. So I find that really helpful. Upgrade your refrigerator, your air conditioner, if they're more than 5 years old. Wash your clothes in cold water. If you have a timer setting on your washing machine, set it to go off between 11 p.m. and 4 a.m. because that's the most efficient time for us to run big appliances. Packaging, don't buy bottled water. Carry your own takeout container. If you're reheating your soup, use your microwave rather than your oven. These are all things that we can do. They're small, they're simple, but they are things that are effective. I like this pie graph that comes from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Especially I like it because there's a wedge that talks about the stuff that you buy. Most carbon calculators don't include that information. Stuff you buy is 26%. These are facts that surprise me. Maybe you know them. Maybe you don't. If your garbage cart isn't full, don't wheel it to the curb. Wait until it is. Snow tire technology is a lot better. We don't necessarily need four-wheel drives to get through our winters. Snow tires do the job, and that means that we're more efficient for half the year. Running a full dishwasher load is more efficient than washing dishes by hand. Awesome. And meat has an enormous carbon footprint, whether it's local or not. This came from the Environmental Working Group. I hadn't seen this before, but the thing that I found really interesting about this is that so the way this breaks down is the green portion of the bar will show you what the emissions are before they leave the farm. The orange portion is after they leave the farm. You know, 27 kilograms of carbon dioxide go into making 1 kilogram of beef. I didn't know that. That's quite a bit of carbon. So how much carbon dioxide do I create? Well, let's see. This is an average, and I took the number from the EPA. There are several, and this is just for tonight's purposes. You know, everybody is different. Everybody's consumption rates are different, but the ones that I'm using are 19.8%. So, you know, going back to our climate plan, we're trying to reduce our residential footprint by 22%. So if we look at our 2.2 million metric tons of carbon dioxide, we translate that to pounds because I don't know what metric tons means. So 22% of that is a little more than 1 million pounds. Reduce that by 8%, that's 85,362 pounds. Let's round it up, 85,500 pounds. So what does that look like? What do I need to do as an individual to make some progress toward that goal? Well, if I have an old refrigerator and I replace it, that's going to save 617 pounds. All right. If I use my laundry line for half of the laundry that I do, that'll save 900 pounds. Excellent. If I have an old 1970s furnace, which my house had, and I replace that, 3,550 pounds. Okay. And if I, say, have a commute that's 40 miles round trip, and I decide I'm going to carpool with a coworker one day a week, that's going to save me 1,100 pounds. So altogether, I'm going to come up with about 6,200 pounds a year. All right, that feels pretty good. That's a huge investment for me to make. It's a huge financial investment. It's a huge time investment, and it's a huge behavior change, breaking a new habit, or breaking a habit investment. So let's see how that looks against our community's climate goals. And I think this is where we get tripped up, because it feels like there is nothing that we can do that makes a difference. And that's really discouraging and really disheartening and upsetting. But that's not the right model. This is the model that we need to be following. it's not one house that we're looking at, it's 10 houses. If we had 15 houses to take those steps, we've exceeded our goal. 15 houses, there are 45,000 houses in our city. We just need 15. This is doable. There are so many roads to victory here, so many roads to success. We just need to get on one, and we need to stay on it, and we need to get our friends and our family and our neighbors to get on with us. And this is the thing that I come back to. Again, it's the behavior wedge. And this is an idea that we are still within that window where we can take actions that will put us on a path to sustainability, that will kind of neutralize our carbon footprint and get us in a position where we can buy the time that we need by reducing our emissions now to develop and implement the technologies that will preserve us into the future. And I find this really inspiring and really moving because, you know, getting on the path is like being on, taking on a new exercise regimen. You'll stay on it if you do it with a friend. And this is not just that you're doing it with a friend, you're doing it for a friend. You're doing it for the people that you love. I'm doing it for you, and you're doing it for me, and you're doing it for my kids. And we're in a community where this is something that we can do together. And, you know, climate change is our biggest threat. But it is also our biggest chance to come together as a community. And this is our opportunity to do it. None of us should walk out of this room tonight without signing up to do something. Maybe it is that you sign up to start a Meatless Monday campaign, and you do that in your neighborhood or at your kid's school. Maybe it is that you start an eco team, and that means that, you know, you look into low-flow faucets, and you look into how to program that thermostat. And you look into what buses in your neighborhood will get you and your neighbors downtown, and you share that information with each other. We can do this. And I want to live in a community where we teach each other these things and where we share this with each other, because we can't do this by ourselves. And I think we do live in that community, and I hope that you guys will sign on and talk to us about it and share your ideas too. Thanks.
So our final speaker of the night is Mike Garfield. Mike is the director of the Ecology Center and longtime community advocate. He's worked in this community for many years on a huge number of environmental issues, but this community climate partnership is really being led by the Ecology Center. He's going to tell us a little bit more about that and how to get involved.
Evening. I'm going to get right to the point. The Ecology Center convened this community climate partnership in order to take action now. We know what needs to be done. There's been a great deal of work, great deal of terrific work done to articulate the steps that the city needs to take. There's a great enthusiasm and a great commitment in this community to do what needs to have happen. About 7 years ago, The Ecology Center organized a screening of An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's documentary about climate change at the Michigan Theater, and it was followed by a panel discussion. It was on a Sunday evening, late at night, and I figured nobody would show up. It was like 9 p.m. showing, and it had been showing all weekend too, and people had seen it, and. That night, over 1,000 people came out to discuss climate change, 2007. And there was a great discussion then about what needs to happen, and there was great anticipation at the time about what could happen. Since then, you know, there's been a whole lot that's happened politically, a whole lot that's happened socially and technologically on these issues. And I think advocates sometimes wonder what we really need to do first. Or what we need to focus our attention on. Do we focus on policy? Do we focus on personal behavior change? Do we focus on community action, global action? Where do we go with it? There are arguments about what's the best course to take. And the fact is, we need to stop arguing about that. We need to stop worrying. It all needs to happen. As everyone's been saying tonight, we need to move now before the roller coaster smacks into the wall. We need to take action on all of those levels, at the personal level, like Susan was talking about, at the global level, like what Mike was talking about, at the community level, as Susan and Missy were describing. Action needs to happen on every front, all at the same time right now. I know that this community is ready to take that kind of action. Look, all of you came out. The winter storm Vulcan's death grip on Ann Arbor let loose on its hold just briefly this evening, and all of you came out tonight. I thought a dozen people were going to come out to this event tonight. And look at the room. People are. I think you're here. I imagine you're here because you want to figure out how to get involved. Well, here's how you get involved. This Community Climate Partnership is establishing working teams. We're calling them priority teams to deal with each of the particular areas identified in the Climate Action Plan to start to focus energies in the city. In a moment, Mike is going to lead a process where we're going to talk about things that each of you can do right now and what you may want to get involved in as the project goes forward. Get involved. I know you already are. You probably wouldn't be here if you weren't taking steps in your own lives right now. I'll bet some of you were at that documentary screening back in 2007. I know to some extent I'm preaching to the choir, and sometimes we're disappointed when we think we're preaching to the choir. But I think it's great that the choir is here and the choir is getting involved. It's time for the choir to sing and sing loudly and take action on this issue and make it happen in a big way. Right here in Ann Arbor. If we can't take significant climate action here in Ann Arbor, who is going to take significant climate action in Michigan? Who's going to take significant climate action across the United States? That's why we've convened this climate partnership. That's why we wanted to acquaint you with the project tonight here. And now I'm going to hand this back to Mike Schreiberg to lead you through a discussion about how we get started. Thanks.
How can Ann Arbor not have a line back here?
Thank you.
So, Susan, I really like the way that you're framing this and the way you distilled it right down, because I agree with Mike completely. I think we really are at an exciting point where there's a very shared sense of something's amiss out there. But folks don't know what to do. They just need... I think the time really is right, and the way that you just walked that right down to numbers, how you could add them up, the image that went across my mind is putting on a wall of a room all the discrete things you could do, have numbers associated, let people go put their own top 10 list together, what's relevant for them, use a school, use a church, use a neighborhood to just kind of ante those up, add them up, get a little competition going. And if you're in the schools and work in the PTGs, I don't know, get a little competition going between a couple elementary schools. Use the existing infrastructure. But I really do think the time's right and was really impressed to see how you had packaged it so nicely.
Thanks.
Please.
I was intrigued by some of the concepts of the use of natural systems, for handling of stormwater, green roofs, the need for more green canopy in the city. And I'm hoping we can look at that even more. I know the city's done a lot with rain gardens and things of that sort, but you know, there's so much more we can learn from how nature just already handles a lot of this stuff. So I'm hoping there are more thoughts about how to push that along a bit more too. I think the work the Watershed Council is looking at is a good start. But there's a lot more we can do in the city, too, in terms of being sure our parks help in things like managing stormwater, our whatever open spaces we've got. So I don't know if any of you have ideas about that or not.
Rebecca or Missy?
Go first. Well, I actually am going to bring up something I don't know a whole lot about, so maybe you won't know more about. Ann Arbor just passed their Green Streets policy, which is working toward using natural infrastructure and alternative technology solutions to do a better job at using the soil as a sponge and trees as a sponge rather than drains and pipes. And that's citywide, I believe. So it's initiatives like that are at a scale, I think, that can be impactful. I also mentioned in my talk the Washtenaw County Water Resources Commission revising their stormwater rules. And they are requiring infiltration of rain on site when an area is developed or redeveloped that really has high expectations for developers and engineers to deal with the water where it falls rather than shipping it off somewhere else to be someone else's problem, our city's problem or our river's problem.
So I'd add, the city's done a health impact assessment. And before I jump into that, I'm going to throw it back to you guys and say, of all the weather impacts that we experience, what do you think is the number one killer where people die from this impact than any other? Exactly, it's heat. Yeah, so tree canopy is not only great for managing stormwater or having just infrastructure, green infrastructure in place, but it also manages heat and helps cool the urban surface. And so the city of Ann Arbor, in conjunction with the state, did a health impact assessment, and Matt Nott in the back may be able to correct me where I'm sure I'll go wrong on this, but looking at where the tree canopy existed and then where vulnerable populations existed, whether that was economically vulnerable, socially vulnerable, or health vulnerable populations. And what we traditionally know is that vulnerable populations have low tree canopy cover. So we're using that information to figure out where to strategically plant and to maintain existing tree coverage or enhance our existing tree coverage. Fair, Matt?
Please.
Hello, my name is Scott. I used to work for the city of Ann Arbor as a naturalist up at the Leslie Science Center. And I know the Nature House up there is a wonderful opportunity for us to expand environmental education around these subjects. I'm surprised we're not there utilizing that venue for an event like this. But I also want to encourage more environmental education along the river. I know there's a site in Ipsy that I've talked to some people about that I'm trying to promote as a training facility for teachers from Michigan, from Eastern, to learn about the river. I think we have a water community here in Ann Arbor, but we don't have that in Ypsilanti. We don't expose the teachers and other students to that opportunity to interact with the river, and I would like to promote that with the Huron River Council. Likewise, you know, I also have been working with the city to try to oppose the paving of paradise, as I call it, and putting up a parking lot, trying to encourage the parking lot here downtown to be a green space for trees and a park where they put up a parking lot, so to speak, and put in infrastructure for a building on top of it. So just trying to encourage more parks and green spaces in town is a very important thing. As we work with the city to do that, I encourage people to get involved politically in the parks that are being formed in town and the areas that are being managed and controlled by the city as they expand their plan into these development strategies to accommodate, you know, climate control. Likewise, with my own opinion right now, is like built a biodiesel plant in Milan, Michigan. It didn't open up. I talked to the city about opening up a biodiesel fueling station here in town and got very good encouragement from that. I haven't seen a alternative fuel fueling station installed in town other than the fact that the city does have the gas pump and some electrical charging stations around town. That's also happening with the university, so I applaud those efforts as well. As an educator, environmental educator, I want to see more activities going on. I don't know if this is being videotaped for community access TV, but I was sort of surprised not to see a camera back here. As we go to these public events, we need to increase the exposure of them. If you feel it's something that needs to go to your city, or I mean to your church, or a smaller community network for exposure to your friends, to replay it, advocate for it. And I'm very grateful that everyone came out tonight, and I'll step back at this point.
Yeah, thank you for that comment. And just as a point of information, it is being videoed from the library, and it will be publicly available. And I personally think the education comment is particularly critical. I've got two small children, and you know, building in the nature appreciation and sort of connections to ecosystems from a very young age, this was what happened naturally for, you know, most of human history. And now we actually have to think about that to unplug and get outside. It actually has to be a conscious effort, right? And we've heard the theories of nature deficit disorder amongst children. That's been a popular – there's a book called that that's been talking about this. And I think that's where you actually build a base as a community, is through that – as an educator myself, it's near and dear to my heart. But I think it's a point very well taken. I don't know if anyone else had a reaction to that.
I just wanted to say that, you know, we do have several cameras right here in the room. And this will be available on our website at aadl.org, but also on community television.
Reactions? Okay. Comment? Doug, yeah.
Doug Kelbaugh. There are a million things we could talk about. I wanted to talk about some low-hanging fruit that maybe Ann Arbor could take the lead in. Green roofs are wonderful, but they're, in fact, very expensive to install and to maintain. I don't think we should hold our breath expecting most of our rooftops to become green roofs. There are architectural issues as well. You need a flat roof and so on. Street trees are an unmitigated gain. I mean, we could list, just out of this audience, we could elicit 8 or 10 good environmental benefits of trees. Very few deficits. But the thing that's been most ignored, in my opinion, is something that the Secretary of DOE first proposed, a Nobel Prize winning scientist at that, and that is simply painting our roofs white. It is much cheaper. Infinitely cheaper than green roofs. And if you want to deal with rainwater detention or retention, barrels and cisterns are actually cheaper than green roofs as well. It turns out it deals with both local heat island or urban heat island effect, that is the local gain in temperature based on sensible heat that has nothing to do with global climate change, but it also helps on global climate change. The albedo of the city is improved. So it has both global and local benefits. It's incredibly cheap. And no one has sort of seized it. It's something that some city ought to own and take the lead in, and I think Ann Arbor could do that. Thanks.
Thank you, Doug.
I'll just say that's a wonderful strategy, and I wouldn't say no city has seized on it. New York City, under Mayor Bloomberg, did advance significantly, trying to rapidly scale up both green roofs and white roofs, and there are a lot of pretty strategic photos of Mayor Bloomberg painting roofs white. So that is one of the strategies they're looking at. But I agree, they haven't taken that as sort of their big thing, and well, let's see Ann Arbor take it.
Please.
Hi, Missy, I was really glad to hear you talking about vulnerable populations, and I think that there's also, you know, it's the people who have nowhere cool to go when it's hot or nowhere warm to go when it's cold, and I was wondering if you knew of any places that are looking at, like, shelters and that sort of thing, in addition to kind of greenerizing the environment. There's a better word for that. So I just wondered if anybody else has thoughts about vulnerable populations, health-wise, economic-wise, and climate change.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really common strategy, particularly during heat waves, is to figure out how we open cooling centers, but we also get people to cooling centers. There's a number of cities that are working on this. A project that we actually did with Detroit, Phoenix, Philadelphia, and New York was looking specifically at how to get people to cooling centers because they feel like they have them. And I will say one of the most interesting things we found, in particular in the elderly population, the reason they wouldn't go to a cooling center was because cooling centers don't accept pets. And no one's going to leave their pet at home to die in the heat that they would be experiencing. So one of the strategies that those communities are looking at is, where do you create a space for people to bring pets? So maybe there's a special shelter because some people are allergic to animals, and so you've got to kind of navigate that space. But that's one strategy that's being looked at. There are a lot of things with vulnerable populations. We didn't even scratch the surface. And the reality is that's one of the hardest things to talk about, and we have to figure that out.
Erica.
Hi, my name is Erica Bloom, and I live in Ypsilanti, but I work for the Michigan League of Conservation Voters, and I'm kind of wearing my MLCV hat with this comment question. I wanted to comment on the work that we're doing at the state level, because I know that this is a citywide kind of initiative, but I also want to kind of let people know that despite, you know, the legislature not being completely, you know, advocating for these issues on a wide scale, there is some movement going on at a statewide level. We are one of the leaders of a coalition called Michigan Energy, Michigan Jobs. And so that really connects all of Michigan to increasing our renewable energy standard in the state, and with the goal of introducing legislation the end of this year. And I guess my question to that is, with the goal of we have 10% by 2015 right now, with the goal of increasing that standard, how does that play, how do cities kind of play into their own renewable energy goals to a bigger statewide standard? Are the two being looked at as kind of parallel, or are our statewide standards and our city goals kind of separate?
When we were, I'm really glad you're here, Erica, and appreciate you making the comment. This evening is focused a lot on community action and on personal and household action, but we can't, as difficult as it might be to make significant changes at the federal or the state level right now, it can't be ignored. And the work that the League of Conservation Voters and a number of other organizations do in this regard is indispensable. When we were drafting the climate action plan, there was a ballot proposal on the statewide ballot to increase Michigan's renewable portfolio standard, and we thought, well, if that passed, it'd be a whole lot easier for Ann Arbor to reach some of the climate goals we were setting for ourselves. It didn't pass, and so we're thinking that what happens here may help to drive state action. Maybe not overnight, maybe not in 1 year, maybe not over 1 or 2 years, but over time. We're not the only ones. Ann Arbor's not the only ones who's trying to take action at the local level. There are activities underway in Detroit, in Ypsilanti, in Traverse City, Grand Rapids, and other parts of the state. If we're successful here, I think it spurs action in other parts of the state. If our friends in other cities are also successful, it moves that faster. I don't think there's been formal coordination of these efforts, but as they start to get traction, I think it'll be more possible.
And that, just to add to that, I think it's really difficult for communities to do this without that state and the federal policy backing. And I'll just speak from at the University of Michigan, we have climate goals that are roughly parallel to what the cities are. And same thing with the renewable energy standard. If the renewable energy provisions of the utilities does not increase, it's going to be extraordinarily difficult for the university to reach its targets. And that's simply because about 50% of the electricity comes directly from DTE. And if that's coming mainly from coal, as it is now, and coal, natural gas, and nuclear power, the greenhouse gas portfolio is no good. And without actual state action to do that, I don't see that profile changing very much. So I think it's a point well taken. And hopefully these efforts actually add power to the state efforts that LCV and others are involved in. Thank you very much. So right here and then.
Hi, my name's Pat Martz. I'm a downtown resident, and my ears really perked up when you mentioned a tree canopy policy, that there's a new policy encouraging an increase in the tree canopy. And my, my big question is, how is this intersecting with the policies on the electric and power lines? Because when we had the Emerald Ash Borer mess, our trees were removed, and we were told we could not put them back because of the power lines and the phone lines. So how are you working with the utilities to change this?
I think that might be a city question. Matt, you want to take that?
I'm not the city forester, but I'm a little surprised that we didn't allow you. If there's city areas, you should email me and we'll check with the forester and figure it out. The utility company has the right to trim trees away from its power lines, and we don't control that. So our forester does work with DTE on a regular basis, but it's limited what our control is. But I think your specific question about trees being removed and not being allowed to put them back in, check with me, and we'll double-check that with Carrie Gray, our forester. So happy to follow up.
Yeah. So that's Matt Nod, the city's environmental coordinator. Okay, so we have time for two more quick questions. Yes.
Hello, my name is Qilong. I'm from China, and now I'm working for a local company called Sensors. I don't know where you heard it. They're doing the automobile exhaust testing system, and are planning to sell it all over the world. The reason I'm here because they want to sell in China. I don't know whether I can get involved in this community work, even I'm a Chinese.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Okay. Absolutely. I have a question from a very from my perspective, because I rent a room, and they provide a refrigerator. From what I see, it's like 30 years old. And for the renting company, do they have the motivation to change their do they have an economic motivation to change their facility? Do they have get money from the government if they change it? And my point of view is what should be done mostly by the government. Because if I take Amtrak to Chicago, it takes 9 hours. Normally 4 hours delay, 4 hour plan. So I don't have a chance to take take them. I only can drive myself or take a bus. So it's not economically reasonable, but considering the time, I have to do it. So this infrastructure, I don't think on a community level, on a state level, it could be achieved. So in all the people sitting there, what's your perspective? What's the most, who play the most important role in changing the society? Because before I came here, I stayed in Europe for 3 years. What I observed is that the government, the European Union really did a lot to promote, to make different kinds of things that economically feasible and ecologically feasible. And they match these two goals. They make even the normal bulb that costs 50 cents, they test a high on it to make it comparable to the LED. Of course, it's not comparable. But at least you have to pay more for the things that which are not economically good for the environment. Okay. So, And another question. Please answer my first question. What do you think about the government's role in this chain?
Yeah. Let me just take very quickly on the rental housing issue, because that is a huge issue. Okay. 50% of Ann Arbor's housing stock is rental housing, and it's lower energy efficiency for the exact reasons you're talking about. Your landlord would be the one to pay to upgrade your refrigerator, but you're probably paying the utility bill, so the incentive just isn't there. Jamie Kidwell with the city who organized this forum, the Sustainability Associates, been leading an effort to actually look at how do we green the rental housing stock, in part through incentives. So by making it transparent that you're going to be paying more if your landlord doesn't upgrade that refrigerator, and actually trying and you kind of have to have an incentive-based system to do this because the priorities are out of whack there.
I pay the electricity bill and they provide.
Exactly. So the first step is making sure that you know which landlords are energy efficient so your bill goes down. Because right now you actually have a right by city code to do that, but many landlords are not following that. And so you don't necessarily know when you're renting. So the first thing is transparency and information. And I don't know if, Jamie, if you wanted to take a second to do more or not. I didn't want to put you on the spot, but okay.
I'll let us go through our questions first, and then we can talk about that.
Oh, okay. So if anyone has a quick comment, or we've got one more question.
The second, purely academic. Do you think the concept of cities is already obsolete? I mean, if we put so much money in the infrastructure, which in U.S., considering the population density, it makes no sense that we renew this kind of infrastructure because all the people live let's say 1 kilometer, only two people, three people. It makes sense in Europe because of the population density. But whether it makes sense in here, maybe the better to drive a Hummer, right? So, they have a dust road there.
Let me just quickly address the issue of the role of government. In concept, there could be a highly significant role for government in addressing climate change in the United States. And in practice, there are huge effects that government at every level is currently having. Unfortunately, not as proactively and as usefully as I'd like to see it. And to talk about the challenges and issues that are getting in the way of that being more successful, you'll have to come to Arbor Brewing for a longer discussion.
Perfectly. Okay, and one final question, please.
Hi, my name is Bill Burge. I had a quick technical question. There are many parts of this program that rely on things that don't relate to the environment, to the atmosphere. But one of the big ones is, of course, the carbon generation. And one of the early charts that showed very definitive numbers for where those emissions come from, homes and UVM, et cetera. And you have some very definitive criteria for reduction over the 20 years or so. Do we really have the mechanism to A, measure, and B, be for each one of those in the city? I mean, that's kind of technically a tough thing to do.
Yeah, I can address that a little bit. It's challenging, and actually the most challenging one is transportation, and we're using some fairly large estimates to get that because we don't actually know how many miles everyone is driving. A lot of that information is based on sort of regional estimates. Much of the rest of the data, actually, the utility companies have that. DTE has that, and it's a matter of accessing that data, which the city has been able to do not consistently but occasionally, and that's where a lot of the information comes from. I don't know if anyone else wanted to jump in.
People feel comfortable about the ability to measure and assess improvement then?
Yeah, I think I'll speak just for myself on that. I think we're comfortable in setting strong goals and trying to figure out ways to achieve them, and I think we'll see measurable reductions. There's obviously some variability around those numbers, but I think the precise numbers aren't as much the issue as are we as a community moving strongly in the right direction. I think that's what the climate goals are about, and that's what the community climate partnership is trying to move towards.
Good.
So.
Thank you.
And Mike, I would just add, there are literally protocols and standards that outline how you measure greenhouse gas emissions at the local level. And so there's consistency so that cities are measuring things the same way, both in terms of what the emissions are and the reductions from those emissions. And Ann Arbor's been following them.
Great. So I want to close this first by giving a round of applause to Jamie Kidwell, the City Sustainability Associate, who organized.